Session number 903.
Mr. Watson, Reel 1. When did you first go to India, Mr. Watson?
I went in January 1932.
And what was your purpose?
Well, I'd been abroad before. I had 3 years in Kenya. Then I came back and did 3 years in a public school in England. And I very much wanted to go abroad again, and I thought that this was a very good opportunity. I liked the sound of India, and so I applied for the post in the Prince of Wales Royal Indian Military College in Dehradun, and after an interview was accepted.
What was the post as?
Sorry?
What was the post as?
Science master for the college, which consisted of boys who were selected by the Defence Department of India as suitable material to become officers in the Indian Army, in the Indian Armed Forces.
Had you been a school teacher before this?
Oh, yes. I'd done 8 years teaching before I went out to India.
And had you been teaching in Kenya?
I had, yes. At public school there. Incidentally, that was called the Prince of Wales School as well.
And how did you get to know about the job in India?
It was advertised in the Times. And I saw the advertisement, and I liked the sound of it, and just applied.
Had you had any military background of your own?
No, none at all.
Or in your family?
No. Nor was it necessary, from the point of view of the appointment. It was entirely an educational appointment rather than an army one, although it was an army school.
Can we go on to talk a little bit about the military college itself? When was it established?
It was opened by the then Prince of Wales, later the Duke of Windsor, in March 1919. The idea being, as I said, to find suitable material for officers in the Indian Armed Forces. It was established then, and until the academy was opened in 1932, the Indian Military Academy was opened, cadets from the military college were sent to Sandhurst and Woolwich, and then Cranwell later on when Cranwell was opened.
And did the college, the authorities who were recruiting you, did they give you any special preparation before you went to India? Any advice about what you should take and so on?
Well, a limited amount of advice regarding the type of clothing that one should want, but apart from that, there's no other advice or even any needed. I was interviewed at India House, and on the board of interviewers was one of the staff from the military college, and of course he put me wise to the whole thing after the appointment had been fixed. So that was quite simple.
Who else interviewed you?
I really don't know. Some high people high up in the hierarchy of the Indian Defence Department, but who they were I've no idea at all.
And when you went out to India, how did you? By what method did you travel? Did you go in a troop ship?
No. We were given P&O passages. We invariably travelled P&O. We were allowed for. Well, incidentally, we were recruited, if that's the right word, for on a permanent basis by the Secretary of State for India. And the period was to last 25 years, or 60 if you reached that age before your 25 years were up. And during that period, you were allowed 4 first-class passages by P&O boat. So we always travelled P&O.
And what was it like on board ship?
Oh, it was the usual type, just as it is now, I think, on these pleasure cruises. It was a very pleasant journey indeed. The usual dances and various deck games and swimming pool and so on, and life was very pleasant.
What kind of accommodation did you have on board ship?
Well, we had a 2-berth cabin, and it was all quite simple, quite straightforward.
This was for you and your wife?
Yes.
And were there any other people on board ship who were going out to take a similar type of job?
No, I don't think there were. There were mostly army officers and what we used to call box swallows. That is to say, people who are going out on business to firms or as representatives of firms in India, and their wives and families, if they had any. And all the P&O cruises were like that in those days.
Was it regarded as a polite term, this term box swallow?
Oh yes. There was nothing impolite about it. I mean, it was just a name that was given to them, I think, originally, probably by the army. I wouldn't swear to that.
So you could use the term within their hearing?
Oh yes. Oh, they didn't mind. They knew it perfectly well.
What about, talking about life on board the P&O liner, was life on board very snobbish or full of class distinction?
I don't think so, no. I think perhaps it was if you were on a first and second class boat, because then the first class did keep itself away from the second class. But if it was a tourist boat, there was no distinction whatsoever. And actually, we had the privilege of changing our first-class return passages to second or tourist-class passages so that we could actually get more leaves instead of the 4. And a vast number of people did that, so that I don't think there was any question of snobbishness at all.
How many extra leaves did you get out of that?
I think we got 6, I think it was. Maybe 7, 6.5, something like that.
So you got 2 or 3 extra ones,
yes,
did you?
Yes.
Did you travel what's known as posh? Port side out, starboard
out? If one got the chance. I mean, it was a question of you had to take what booking they had available at the time.
It was just pot luck, was it?
Very much so, yes. You invariably tried that, naturally, because it was a question of being cool, actually. Port side going out was the cool side. And you didn't get the hot sun going through the Mediterranean, through the Red Sea, for instance. And the starboard coming back.
So there's no question of extra payment to...
Oh, no. Oh, no, none at all. So that term posh is a very misleading term in actual fact.
Was life on board ship boring at any stage?
Oh, I don't think so, no. There was always plenty to do, and deck games and so on. One kept oneself amused and fit, and I think it was an enjoyable time. It wasn't all that long. If you went from Tilbury or King George V dock, it took about 15 days, but after the first voyage or so, one invariably went from Marseille, across France by train to Marseille, and caught the boat, the P&O boat there, after it had come round. And the same coming back. We used to get off at Marseille and catch the train and come straight across France. It meant a few more days' leave.
Were you ever seasick?
I wasn't, no. Never bothered me.
Well, what about the other passengers?
Oh, yes, some of them did, yes. I mean, I don't think anyone was ever really seriously ill. They had their bouts, yes, and there'd be empty spaces at meal times. But after the first few days, they usually got over it. And, of course, a lot of them were seasoned travellers, too, in those days.
Did you arrive at Bombay?
I did.
What was your first impression of Bombay?
Well, I think the thing that struck me most of all was the incredible noise and the shouting and coughing and spitting and general hubbub that was going on. And I think that's sort of India. It's representative of India. I think even today it's just the same. We got off at the Ballad Pier, and in those days there was a boat train came right down to the pier, and we got onto the boat train, and then we went straight up to Dehradun. It took two nights in the train, and there again the journey up was interesting in that it was terribly noisy. Every station you stopped at through the night there was banging and shouting and coolies crying and wailing and noises of people offering hot milk, dood garam, and cha mangta, do you want any tea, going up and down the platform. And then you'd find the coolies, the passengers trying to get onto the train, rattling the doors, trying to get in. Of course, our seats were always booked. One always booked seats on these trains. And it was very important to keep all the doors and windows locked. Otherwise, you could have had all sorts of intruders. Another interesting thing, which I'd never struck before, was the arrangement of the windows. There were three windows, three stages of window, rather. There was the outside one, which was glass, then inside that was a shutter, and then inside that again was gauze. So you had three to shut before you shut the window. The gauze was to keep the dust out as far as possible, which it never did. And the glass was to keep the inside either cool in the hot weather or hot in the cold weather. And the shutter was to keep the room reasonably dark if you wanted it dark. There's always been a lot of trouble with people poking their hands in and pinching things from the racks and so on. It was quite an interesting experience. As I say, it took two nights, and then we arrived in Dehradun. This was on an early morning in January. I think it was January the 5th, as far as I remember. And I was met, it was a beautiful morning, crisp. I was met by the principal, Cam Scott. And he drove me from the station up to the college grounds, which was in cantonments. And I was delighted by the scenery. It was, the grounds were splendidly laid out, and then in the background we had the foothills of the Himalayas, where I found out that the hill station Mussoorie was. So that it was really a beautiful scene to see one's first, to have one's first visit to Dehradun.
So the college was on the site of a military cantonment, was it?
It was. It was part of the military cantonment. Outside the college gates there was a huge, what we call a maidan, which is an open green space. And on the far side there was actually a regiment of Gurkhas who were stationed there.
And did the college have much to do with the troops who were stationed at the cantonment?
Only from a game's point of view and meeting the officers socially, that's all. I mean, we invariably had games with them, I mean football and so on. For instance, the Gurkha was a very good footballer, and there were always dinner parties and meeting at the Dehradun club. But apart from that, no.
Was it the teachers or the pupils who played sport against the Gurkhas?
Both. We usually used to have a mixed team of about three staff, with the rest of the side would be cadets. That was a sort of normal procedure in those days.
Can we talk about the pupils who attended the college? Can you tell me what walks of life did they come from?
Well, they actually came from every conceivable walk of life. They were interviewed at the age of about 11 or 12 by the Defense Department. They had a written and an oral examination, and the parent had to sign a form to say that if accepted, his boy would take up a career in the Indian Armed Forces. Then they came to us, and they stayed with us until they were about 18, perhaps 19, after which they had another examination and they went on to the Indian, what was in my time, the Indian Military Academy. Prior to that, as I say, they went to Cranwell. They had to take the English Civil Service examination, and they went to Sandhurst and Woolwich, and if they wanted to Cranwell.
And when you said that they came from all walks of life, do you mean that they came from both military and non-military backgrounds?
Oh yes, very definitely. We used to have one or two parents who had served in the Indian Army as subedars, jemadars, and other ranks, determined that their son should follow in their footsteps and go into the Indian Army. On the other hand, a vast number, in fact the greater number, I think, were just ordinary people who saw no prospect for their sons unless they had some job like getting into the armed forces. And they were very keen that they should join, because they knew that once they were in, they were there for life. So, as I say, there was a tremendous cross-section. Incidentally, we also had one or two what I might call outsiders, although that's not the right word. The odd cadet from Nepal, for instance. We had one from Burma. But apart from that, of course, they were all either Indians or with a very small number of Anglo-Indians.
What about religious community? Did they come from all religious communities, or was there a preponderance of one?
No. I should say that very roughly one third of them were Muslims, and a third Sikhs, and a third Hindus. That's very rough. There were two or three Christians. They messed together. They lived together. There was no segregation of any kind whatsoever. And I must say they all got on extremely well, and they still do as far as I know.
Were there any instances of communal antagonism between these students?
None at all. Never.
Was it completely unknown?
In my time, and that's over 20 years, absolutely unknown. Never any trouble at all.
And coming back to the question of social background, did the students include those who had come from aristocratic backgrounds as well?
Oh yes. We had chief sons of Rajas. In fact, it's an interesting point. The college originally even before it was opened in 1919, there was a previous existence of that college when it was entirely chief's sons, Rajas, Maharajas, and so on. Then that died, and it wasn't revived again until 1919. I forget how long it was defunct. I think about 10 years, something like that. And when it was reopened, as I say, there was no question of distinction between sects or question of the rich and the poor at all. There was no attempt at that. Provided the boy or his parent wanted to go into the army, or his parent wanted the boy to go into the army, rather, then, and provided he passed the examination, it didn't matter what his background was.
But didn't you find it's a problem with boys who had come from these very privileged backgrounds, from the homes of aristocrats, fitting into such a democratic life in college?
No, none at all. Remember that they were under a military discipline right from the word go. They were young and therefore adaptable. And because of that, I'm quite sure that it worked extremely well. And there never was any trouble.
But those boys would have been used to having servants, wouldn't they?
That's an interesting point, because there was a case where one of the sons of a chief did bring his bearer with him, but it just wasn't allowed. And after a time, in fact, immediately, the boy simply got down to it and coped by himself without the bearer.
So you just sent the bearer home?
That's right, yes.
What proportion of the people at the academy had come from your college?
When it first opened, I should say about 4/5, I would imagine. I'm rather in the dark there as to the actual amount, because we were the only real college in the whole of India which catered exclusively for the armed forces. There were other colleges in India and schools in India who had one or two select boys who wanted to go into the armed forces, but they were in a minority. So that, largely speaking, they came mostly from the military college, Dehradun. It's an interesting fact that at partition, three quarters, if not more, of the high-ranking officers, that is to say colonel and upwards, all came from the military college. Most of them, of course, had been through Sandhurst and Woolwich.
And what about the transition from the college to the academy? Was it a more or less automatic transition?
Well, they had to pass an examination. Apart from that, it was automatic.
But did the examination amount to more or less a formality? I mean, did everybody more or less pass?
More or less everybody, yes. There were, you naturally got the odd exception here and there. Later on, during the war, they started a selection board. And then it became rather more difficult for the boy to go direct into the academy. For instance, I remember one boy who was one cadet who was outstanding in every way. He was extremely intelligent. He was very capable. But because at his selection board he didn't exert his authority, he was failed. Which was a great pity, because I think the army lost a considerable loss in that boy.
Was it just an interview he had to go through?
Well, no, they had the selection board, which consisted of 3 days where they had various tests, like bridging gaps over holes in the road and so on, and organizing groups to do certain jobs. And they were in groups of 3 or 4 or half a dozen, I can't remember now. And what they were looking for was authority in that particular group. And unless the boy showed it, unless the cadet showed it, he stood a good chance of being failed. But prior to that, it was more or less formal. They had to pass a written examination, and if they were up to the standard, well, they were automatically accepted.
Was this an exam in all subjects?
Yes. English, mathematics, geography. I can't remember the number that they had. And a general paper. Oh, and a science paper too. I think they had a choice.
Were all the teachers at the college English or not?
They were entirely English, or British rather, except for the religious instructors. We were all recruited by, as I say, the Secretary of State for India. And apart from us, there were the 3 religious instructors, one for the Sikhs, one for the Hindus, one for the Mohammedans. Otherwise, as I say, they were all British. That lasted up till just before partition. And then when partition was very much in the offing, we knew that the Secretary of State for India post would be abolished, and we were told that our agreement would be terminated because his post had been abolished, and we were given the opportunity either of leaving or staying on contract, a year's contract at a time, which later was increased to 2 years. Well, the staff decided, except for 2, the staff decided they would leave. And there were only 2 of us left at the time of partition. Of course, they then began to Indianize, to recruit Indians to replace the Britishers who'd gone. To begin with, they got